The beginning of the end was really February 1st, 2007, when news broke that Universal had won a bidding war over a project called Nottingham, a big-budget reimagining of the Robin Hood legend starring Russell Crowe and written by Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris. And for Reith and Voris, this was the kind of deal that you dream about as a writer. Your script becomes one of the hottest properties in town with a big star attached and multiple studios vying to make your movie. Reith and Voris weren't unknown writers. They'd been Emmy-nominated for their Showtime series Sleeper Cell, and they worked on Kung Fu Panda. But Nottingham really was a passion project. Here's Ethan Reith on how it all got started.
I'm the big history guy writ large, and then I'm a big medieval history guy when you drill down into my particular areas of obsessive interest. And over the years of Cy and my professional partnership, we had talked about, or I had talked to him about, different possible medieval period pieces that we might write as a spec script, meaning something we just write on our own, on speculation, and then put out into the marketplace, and you hope that somebody bites and wants to buy it. And either Cy or I, maybe I was pushing Cy about some medieval idea, and maybe Cy said, if we do Robin Hood, at least Robin Hood, I mean, I'll care about Robin Hood enough that I might want to do a medieval movie or write a medieval movie.
And as Reith says there, they wrote the Nottingham script on spec rather than pitching the idea to studios because, honestly, it was a pretty hard sell as a pitch. Nottingham wasn't your classic Robin Hood story because it wasn't about Robin Hood. It was about the Sheriff of Nottingham. For those who aren't cursed with an encyclopedic knowledge of Robin Hood mythology, the Sheriff of Nottingham is one of the villains of the legend. It's the role Alan Rickman played in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But in Nottingham, the Sheriff was reimagined as a civil servant just trying to do the right thing in a fundamentally unfair feudal society. And he was also using medieval forensics to solve a series of archery-based murders with all evidence suggesting that the killer was Robin Hood. That top-line pitch is pretty intriguing to me, but I can absolutely understand why Reith and Voris decided to write the script on spec rather than just pitching the idea. They wanted people to read the screenplay as a whole and see how those two very disparate story elements of dedicated civil servant and hunting a serial killer came together. They tinkered with Nottingham in their spare time while also showrunning Sleeper Cell for 2 seasons. And then the day after Sleeper Cell was cancelled, they got word that Russell Crowe was interested in starring in Nottingham. And less than a week later, Nottingham was bought by Universal, in a deal where Universal basically footed the bill and left the actual filmmaking to Imagine Entertainment. Ron Howard and Brian Grazer's Oscar-winning production company who made Apollo 13, Arrested Development, and all 3 Tom Hanks Da Vinci Code movies. Almost a year after that deal was signed, during the 07-08 writers' strike, Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris did an interview with the blog Why We Write, where they talked a bit about Nottingham while answering the question, why we write? And I find what they said really relatable. Quote, "We write because of our own audience frustration. We both love movies. We both grew up watching movies constantly. They were our guidebook for life. When we got old enough to understand how they got made, we wanted to make sure we'd get to see more movies we would enjoy, and sometimes the only way to do that is to write that movie yourself. Why did we write Nottingham? Because one of us grew up loving Robin Hood, and the other has a lifelong obsession with medieval history, and we both wanted to see this new version of the classic story for ourselves." But even when Reith and Voris said this, Nottingham had already started to change without them. In April 2007, Ridley Scott was hired to direct the film, kicking off a wave of changes that would render Nottingham unrecognisable when it was released in 2010. It became a bloated, gritty, historical war movie slash origin story that bore the scars of its constant rewrites, and felt like 3 different films duct-taped together. Over time, the characters of the Sheriff and Robin Hood were merged, and then flipped. And the title was eventually changed to reflect this. From Nottingham to Robin Hood. This is Going Rogue, and today we are talking about Ridley Scott's 2010 version of Robin Hood, and how an interesting, inventive, and slightly insane screenplay can slowly be sanded down into the very thing it wasn't meant to be. I'm your host, Tansy Gardam, and I have a kind of weird relationship with this story because I follow Nottingham's transformation into Robin Hood in real time as a distant observer because as a teenager, I was obsessed with Robin Hood. My sincere apologies to anyone who knew me at the time. But before we can talk about Nottingham, we need to talk about Robin Hood and its strange place in pop culture. Because if you ask anyone what's the deal with Robin Hood, you'll get an answer. Rob the rich to give to the poor, bow and arrow, green hat with a feather in it, tights, maybe Maid Marian and the Merry Men. If you push a little further, you might get the idea of Robin as an outlawed former nobleman living in Sherwood Forest, and you might get some other guys like Little John, Prince John, King Richard the Lionheart, and maybe the hero of today's episode, the Sheriff of Nottingham. Ask a freak like me and you'll learn things you don't want to know about other deep cut characters like Will Scarlet, Alan Adair, or Guy of Gisborne, the increasingly common addition of a black or Muslim character, as well as the historical context of the late 12th century and the Third Crusade. But there is something missing from that laundry list of things that we consider to be part of the Robin Hood legend. And that's a story. There is no big classic Robin Hood story. The Robin Hood legend is a series of characters in a place and a time and an archery competition. That's not a story, that's a series of improv prompts. There is that core idea of robbing from the rich to give to the poor, but again, that's not really a story. That's an ethos. It can only get you so far. Compare that to King Arthur, the other titan of British folklore who also gets a film once a decade. There's the big archetypal legend of King Arthur, reclaiming his stolen throne, pulling the sword from the stone, being given Excalibur by the Lady of the Lake, probably some other things that don't involve getting a sword, and the characters around him all have their own stories as well. Guinevere and Lancelot's affair, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Sir Bedivere also being there. Compared to Arthurian legend, Robin Hood is paper thin. And I think it is worth pointing out that the two good Robin Hood movies are a Disney cartoon and a parody, and they're both able to do the broad strokes and tropes of Robin Hood without having to do character arcs or a strong narrative. They are both very episodic movies. And they're also able to hit a classic Robin Hood tone that a lot of modern adaptations fumble. Robin Hood should be fun, swashbuckling, optimistic, and a little bit silly. Robin Hood does not need to be gritty. Please stop trying to make Robin Hood gritty. Nottingham did, to some degree, try to make Robin Hood gritty. The first draft of Ethan Reith and Cyrus Vorace's Nottingham screenplay is easily available online. And while I am going to do a brief summary of the plot here, there is a reason that Reith and Vorace wanted it to be read as a whole screenplay rather than just pitched in brief. The script loses a lot of its flavour and nuance when it's reduced to just a summary, so if you are interested in this film, or just screenwriting in general, it's definitely worth having a read of the full screenplay, and forming your own opinions about the tone and vibe, and where it succeeds and fails. The screenplay for Nottingham opens not in Nottingham, but in Cyprus, with a castle under siege. The English are holding the fort, and the Cypriots are trying to get it back by tunnelling in under the walls. But under the canny leadership of Sir Robert Tornham, the English have dug their own tunnel, which the Cypriots unknowingly dig into and leave themselves open to ambush. And then the English can use the Cypriot tunnel as a direct route behind enemy lines. It's quite a smart, concise battle scene. And in reward for his services in the battle scene, Sir Robert Tornham is sent back to England as the new Sheriff of Nottingham. Smash cut to Nottingham, miserable, rainy, and English, where one of the first things Tornham does as sheriff is threaten to bring the law down on a dodgy brothel owner. Not because he's running a brothel, but because he's overcharging the sex workers on their rent, which is admittedly a based thing for the sheriff to get involved with. Tornham is then met by Guy of Gisborne, a minor lackey of the sheriff in the Robin Hood legend. Nottingham's Gisborne is a soldier who has been acting as sheriff until Tornham arrives, and he can also act as Sir Guy of Exposition. He gives Tornham the lay of the land, and in particular, warns him to stick to the Norman section of town, because there's a killer on the loose, targeting noblemen, an outlaw named Robin Hood. He lives in the woods and robs carts with his men, and because he's only killing noblemen and throws a few pennies to the poor from time to time, he's become a folk hero, according to Gisborne, and he's getting away with murder. But Tornham doesn't just accept what Gisborne tells him. He asks to see the bodies of the latest victims and proceeds to do some proper corpse examination. There's not much to go off, just an arrow wound and some traces of beeswax on both victims' faces. So Tornham then visits the crime scene next to Sherwood Forest and starts theorising about how powerful a bow the killer must have used, how close he would have had to be, what sort of arrows he'd need. Gisborne says he can't help because he's a swordsman, not an archer, and then Tornem starts to get out rope to work out the angle and distance that the arrow must have been fired from. I was not kidding when I said medieval forensics. Tornem confirms the arrow would have come from the woods, which backs up the theory that Robin Hood is the killer, but Tornem still isn't convinced, so he asks whose land the victims were killed on, and Guy of Exposition says it all belongs to Lady Marian, Robin Hood's betrothed. Cut to a hospital where a young woman is trying to settle down a madman who won't listen to her because she's a girl. Marian, like all the characters in Nottingham, is not at all like the blushing maid in the legend. This version is a charitable but steel-cored noblewoman with a sharp, inquiring mind, who runs a hospital as part poorhouse, part halfway house, and part madhouse. And she tells Tornem what Gisborne left out. That Robin Hood was unjustly outlawed for defending a miller who killed a king's deer to feed his family. The miller was executed and Robin was sentenced to be blinded for defending him, so he took off into the forest instead. Marian insists that he will one day be pardoned and she intends to marry Robin once King Richard returns from the Crusades. Tornem tells her not to hold her breath on that one, which is a fun little joke for the history nerds in the audience. Marian accuses Tornem of knowing nothing of love and Tornem replies that he knows a good deal about love. But what he loves is justice. Yes, that is the line in the script. And while Tornem says the only thing he loves is justice, by the time he's done talking to Marian, our boy is down atrocious. But before Tornem can really do anything about the killer or Robin Hood, the royal family graces Nottingham with their presence. Prince John and his mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine, the real power behind the throne. There's a hunt to celebrate their arrival where Prince John almost gets Robert Baratheon'd by a wild boar, but it's taken down at the last second by an arrow fired by Marian. Tornem tries awkwardly to compliment her on her archery, and Marian says she's also an exceptional horsewoman and then immediately disappears on horseback into the woods with big "chase me" vibes. Tornem follows her, but instead of catching up to Marian, he is himself captured and knocked unconscious by Robin Hood and his gang of merry men. This happens about a third of the way into the script, by the way. Up until now, we have not seen Robin Hood. And the next time we see him, it's when Tornem is bound to a tree being used for target practice. This is not Errol Flynn or Sean Connery's Robin Hood. He's more like Errol Flynn and Sean Connery in real life. He's rough and ready, blokey and jokey, charming when he needs to be, but a dick when he doesn't. Reith and Varys always envisioned Colin Farrell in the role, and while reports from the time always described Robin Hood as the bad guy of the film, it is not as simple as Robin Hood bad. When Tornem swears that Hood and all of his men will be brought to justice, Robin gets a little monologue about how the law isn't made for men like them, how he was never going to get a fair trial, not under Gisborne and not as a Saxon. And Tornem shoots back that there aren't any pureblood Normans or Saxons anymore, there's just the English, and Robin Hood is fixating on divisions of the past. A little bit of historical context here, since Normans and Saxons come up so much in this script. In the mid-11th century, William the Conqueror did what it said on his tin and conquered England. William was a Norman from Normandy in France, and once he took over, the kings and general nobility of England were also Normans, and there was a very clear social stratification between the Norman nobility and regular citizens, who were mostly Anglo-Saxons. The Normans also brought in a lot of new biased laws. If a Norman was murdered, for example, the entire nearest village could be burned down as punishment. Hunting in the forest was also outlawed under the Normans, which often features in Robin Hood stories. Robin's shown defending some penniless peasant who was persecuted for killing a king's deer, and often outlawed because of it. But the Norman invasion was 150 years before the Robin Hood legend really kicks off. The characters are living under an established Norman aristocracy. King Richard the Lionheart was a Norman and almost definitely didn't even speak English. So in the script for Nottingham, Tornem represents the Normans and law and order as the sheriff, and Robin Hood is a Saxon who is subject to the inherent injustices at the heart of those laws. Tornem has a blind faith in the justice system. After all, it's his first love, and as far as he's concerned, Robin Hood is an outlaw. He exists outside the law. Tornem tells Robin he might as well just kill him, since he wouldn't expect any better, and Robin says he's not a killer. He's being framed for the murders, and he only captured Tornem so he could tell him that face to face. Robin then lets Tornham go, and by the time the sheriff has returned to Nottingham, there's been another murder that Robin couldn't have committed since he was busy using Tornham as a dartboard at the time. And as Tornham grapples with the idea that the murderer really could be anyone, he's visited by Queen Eleanor, the king's mother, who informs him that King Richard has been captured by Austrians. This is another real historical event woven into the story. King Richard really was kidnapped and ransomed on his way back from the Crusades. And this kidnapping and ransoming is actually also the inciting incident of the 1938 Errol Flynn Robin Hood movie, which also makes a big deal out of the divide between Normans and Saxons. Rhys and Voris did their Robin Hood homework, and they also did their history homework, because Eleanor of Aquitaine, while historically relevant, is rarely featured in Robin Hood stories, and they gave her a big role. They write Eleanor as calculating, insightful, and worried that her son John will see an opportunity in Richard's capture. Queen Eleanor is waiting on a ransom demand, and it's going to be high. Taxes will have to rise to meet it, and all methods of collection will have to be employed. At this point, the sheriff's men remember that they're the sheriff's men in a Robin Hood movie, and they start ruthlessly collecting taxes. But this is a different kind of Robin Hood movie, so when they start roughing up a peasant, the sheriff stops them. Tornham is deeply conflicted about all of this because taxation is part of the law. He has no choice but to enforce it, and surely the law couldn't be wrong. But he does slip this particular peasant a couple of coins and then put on a big show of extorting his own money back out of the peasant for the sake of the crowd. Prince John then summons all the lords to the castle and announces Richard is as good as dead. Gisborne and all the other nobles bend the knee and call John Your Majesty, and while Tornham is the last to do it, he does still kneel. We then cut to an archery range, where Marion is teaching Tornham how to shoot, and we learn through dialogue that this is not their first lesson. It's been months, and Tornham still hasn't caught the killer because his men are too busy collecting taxes to investigate. Marion and Tornham have clearly become pretty close, but the spectre of Robin still comes between them, especially when Tornham reveals that he's finally found a way to capture Robin Hood by intercepting him at his weekly confession with Friar Tuck. That night, Marion sneaks into the forest to warn Robin about Tornham's plan, and Tornham is, of course, waiting to follow her straight to Robin Hood. Robin isn't expecting Marion, so of course he's drunk in bed with another woman, who sneaks out the back and immediately runs into Tornham and raises the alarm. Tornham insists that he came alone and he isn't there to capture anyone. He's there to ask Robin Hood's help with his investigation. Robin kind of wants to kill him, but Marion is looking pretty pissed about the half-naked other woman, so Robin does the heroic thing and agrees to help. Tornham shows Robin the arrowheads used in the murders and reveals that there are two letters engraved on them, an S and a P. This is the first time the audience have seen these letters, by the way. Probably could have done with a glimpse at them earlier. Trust me, the audience were not going to figure this one out by themselves, but this is an easy script fix. Robin says SP, killer's initials, obviously, and Tornham says he's not an idiot, so he's already checked all the people in Nottingham with those initials, and there are no matches. Robin interrupts to ask the sheriff if he's married, and then mopes about the fact that women keep throwing themselves at him, but he really does love Marion, and all he really wants is her approval. And Tornham says, of course, he'll get it. Because he's a hero, definitely not a drunk wasting everyone's time. And Robin lashes out that the sheriff thinks he's so clever, but he couldn't even recognise that the SP on the arrows obviously stands for Sagittari Pedestri, or Latin for foot archer. Robin explains that all the supplies for Prince John's invasion of Ireland were engraved to keep track of spending, so these arrows must have belonged to a foot archer from that war. And Tornham is about to ask more, when Guy of Gisborne and his men surround the camp and start the killing. And Tornham is just as confused as everyone else. Robin thinks he betrayed him, but Gisborne really just followed Tornham. He meant to come alone. And as Robin Hood is bound and gagged, we dissolve to the English coastline as a ship pulls in from the fog with a roaring lion figurehead. Back in Nottingham, Prince John proclaims the impending execution of the outlaw and murderer Robin Hood. But Tornham knows Robin is innocent and insists there has to be a trial. Prince John says juries are notoriously unreliable, so Tornham convinces him instead to hold a trial by combat. Robin Hood against Prince John's favourite champion, Guy of Gisborne. Robin isn't thrilled by the news. He's an archer. He doesn't do close quarters fighting, and as far as he's concerned, this is just a death sentence with extra steps. But Tornem isn't giving up on the law yet, so he asks Gisborne not to kill Robin in the trial, just make him yield, which will mean he's judged as guilty in God's eyes, but will still need a sentencing trial, so Tornem can still get his day in court and hopefully still prove that Robin isn't the murderer. Gisborne says that guilty in God's eyes is guilty enough for him, and Tornem finally notices that Gisborne has got a nice new outfit, with a ceremonial badge of office as John's chief butler. He asks how Gisborne got the promotion, and Gisborne explains that he and John go way back. He actually served the prince during his campaign in Ireland. Tornem excuses himself and re-inspects the arrowheads for anyone who wasn't paying attention, and then the next morning when Gisborne leaves for the trial, Tornem sneaks into his rooms. He finds your standard male living space full of edged weapons, but nothing out of the ordinary, apart from a sparkling clean fireplace. No ashes or wood or soot. Tornem feels around the suspicious fireplace and presses the right stone to open a hidden passageway. He follows the passage as, down in the castle courtyard, Marion and Prince John take their places to watch the trial by combat, along with every gawking peasant and noble in Nottingham. Tornem keeps following the secret passage as it moves outside the castle walls and through mud and earth, while up above, Robin and Gisborne are blessed by priests to ensure God is watching and judging the trial, as, on the edge of town, a rider approaches the city gates, carrying the banner of Richard the Lionheart. We go back to Tornem as he finally reaches the end of the tunnel and finds a shadowy sanctum containing a powerful longbow, a stock of arrows from Prince John's Irish campaign, and a pot full of wax. And as Robin and Gisborne begin to fight brutally in the castle courtyard, Tornem discovers a line of wax death masks cast on each of the murder victims' faces, and a list of names, some crossed out, others yet to be killed. He takes the list and emerges from the sanctum into the city streets just in time to hear dozens, if not hundreds, of horses galloping through Nottingham towards the castle, where Robin is fighting a losing battle. He manages to duck and dodge and disarm Gisborne until they're just wrestling on the ground, but Gisborne is bigger, heavier, and he gets a grip on Robin's neck and starts to drown him in the mud. Robin goes limp, and Gisborne takes a victory lap because it's the 12th century, so he hasn't watched Game of Thrones. Robin explodes out of the mud and wraps his arm around Gisborne's throat, and just when it looks like this might have actually worked, a guard raises the alarm that the castle is under attack. John's men rush to defend the castle while Robin is thrown back in the dungeons, and word spreads quickly through the crowd that King Richard has returned. In all the chaos, Marion grabs a sword and rescues Robin from the dungeons, and outside the castle, a captain is delivering a full siege briefing to King Richard. Or rather, to the king's translator, because King Richard was a Norman king who only spoke French. Tornem interrupts the briefing to suggest in French that they just take Gisborne's murder tunnel back behind enemy lines, just like he did in Cyprus, and Richard's army takes the castle. Gisborne decides to cut his losses and just get out of there. So he grabs a horse and scoops Marion up from the crowd as a human shield, knowing that neither Robin nor Tornem will risk hitting her. But Tornem still takes off after Gisborne. He finds Marion thrown off the horse at the edge of Sherwood Forest. She says that Tornem is not the one who she was expecting to rescue her, but he'll do. Tornem recognises his one chance and kisses Marion before leaving in pursuit of Gisborne. But by the time he catches up, Gisborne has managed to turn this into a proper hunt, stalking his prey through the forest. Tornem quickly catches an arrow to the leg and another to the shoulder as Gisborne monologues about how the Irish called John the red-handed, but he was the one who did all of the prince's killing for him. Tornem tries to take a shot at Gisborne, but he has terrible aim, and now he's given away his position. It's a shootout scene, it's just a shootout, and Gisborne was lying earlier when he said he knew nothing about archery. Gisborne manages to hit Tornem's bow and shatter it, leaving him defenseless and wounded as Gisborne stalks towards him, ready to cut off his head. But to do that, Gisborne has to enter melee range. So Tornem uses the last of his strength to pull the arrows out of his leg and shoulder and stab Gisborne with them, one through the knee and one through the chest. Back in Nottingham, the battle is over, and John looks like he might commit suicide, but just tears his clothes and begs forgiveness instead. And Richard doesn't even really give him that, just writes him off as young and stupid and easily misled, while their mother Eleanor looks on, just glad her boys are getting along so well. And we dissolve to Tornem's rooms, where the sheriff has been bandaged but is still unconscious. And when he finally does wake, Queen Eleanor is waiting for him. And she explains that because Gisborne was found in the forest with two arrows through him, the people join the dots and are rejoicing that Robin Hood killed the murderer who has been terrorizing the town. And some are even saying that Robin Hood managed to injure the loathed Sheriff of Nottingham as well. Eleanor tells Tornham that he's a good man, a perfectly functional civil servant, but the people need heroes like Robin Hood and King Richard to unite them and help build kingdoms, and without them, Tornham would have no kingdom to serve. So Tornham quietly pulls out the scroll from Gisborne's sanctum with a list of names and asks Eleanor if all of the victims were supporters of Richard. If this was all done on John's orders, and if so, which is worse? A mad dog or the master who knowingly sets it on innocent victims? And Eleanor, in turn, makes it clear that Gisborne was still alive when he and Tornham were found, but he just couldn't quite recover. And maybe Tornham won't either. After all, Richard is planning his next war and needs to fund it, so he'll be auctioning off posts like the Sheriff of Nottingham, and Tornham isn't rich enough to pay for his own job. But he might get a decent posting in Richard's army in exchange for his silence. And as Tornham contemplates his choices, we dissolve to the edge of Sherwood Forest, and Robin Hood, resplendent in noble finery and restored to his lands and titles by King Richard with a full pardon. And Robin is being genuinely friendly to Tornham, who is still bandaged and battered but ready to leave. Robin actually offers to buy Tornham's job for him, since he's got all this money lying around from his outlawing, but Tornham says he couldn't take a job in law enforcement that was bought with stolen money. Tornham isn't sure where he'll go, but he knows there's nothing for him here. Robin says that Tornham will always be the Sheriff of Nottingham to him, and then excuses himself, saying he has a wedding to attend. His own, it turns out. Marion is waiting for him at the altar. Tornham takes one last look at what might have been, and Marion locks eyes with him before turning back to Robin. And the sheriff turns his horse and rides away, never to return, except, the script says, in folklore, myth, and legend. So, that's Nottingham, or at least the first draft from November 2006, which Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris spent 3 years chipping away at. And it's a kind of hard script to do objective criticism of, especially when you know what it ended up as. But it's definitely a strong read. It walks a really fine line in terms of tone, both deconstructing and building its own version of the Robin Hood mythology, and while the medieval forensics element is a bit silly, it's also a relatively small part of the script. The most egregious examples are just a couple of beats, so if you did hate it, it wouldn't be hard to tone down. For example, instead of Tornham using string to determine arrow angles, you could just show him eyeing up sightlines, which is something that's really easy to do in a visual medium like film. A lot of the script's dialogue is quite zippy, even if it does occasionally lean into, here's a historical fact that is relevant to this time period, and there's also some really solid character work too. Tornham's central conflict between justice and an unjust law has the potential to really resonate with modern audiences. Very few people have positive interactions with law enforcement, and we all know that the system is unjust, but it operates by its own logic. You can't dismantle it from the outside or the inside, and sometimes the only moral choice is to walk away. And as a counterpoint to Tornham's firm judicial internal conflict, you have Marion, who's trying to do her best operating within a system that treats her as inherently lesser, and also Robin, who's trying to live up to his own legend. Nottingham also kind of reminds me of the original pitch for Deadwood. Creator David Milch wanted to make a cop show set in ancient Rome, following the urban guard as they tried to enforce order in a lawless world on the edge of a religious revolution. The pilot was going to end with the protagonist cops arresting St. Paul. And Nottingham also reminds me of the reason that David Milch couldn't make that show. Rome, another series HBO were already making about low-level Roman soldiers trying to be good men in a crooked and fundamentally unfamiliar historical world. These are shows that engage with the beliefs and psychology of their time period, that take historical understandings of what was right and wrong, and have their characters wrestle with their own morality in their time period, rather than just doing the easy thing and applying modern morals to their characters, and judging them by standards that they could not meet or even understand. Nottingham shows Tornham as a forward thinker for his time, but also a unique product of his time. And I know Nottingham isn't for everyone, but it has a dramatic flair mixed with a kind of grounded historical context that I think is really fun. My favourite genre of movie is silly-sounding idea executed really well. Things like Pacific Rim, Stardust, Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, and Star Wars. And I think that Nottingham, at least at script stage, had the potential to be that kind of film. It wouldn't, but it had the potential. Russell Crowe has always kind of wanted to do a Robin Hood film. Ever since he was a kid, the character has held a unique, quite noble appeal to Crowe. According to the man himself,
you know, its core thing, the thing that attracts me and has attracted me since I was a five-year-old kid, you know, is that there's some guy out there who'll go and work on behalf of the people that can't do something for themselves, you know? There's a guy out there who'll rob from the rich and give to the poor.
And this is where talent and skill really give way to luck in this story. Because Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris happen to be represented by WMA, the same agency as Russell Crowe. So Russell Crowe's agent, George Freeman, read the script, and the reported timeline goes like this. Thursday, January 25th, 2007, Reith and Voris learn that their Showtime series Sleeper Cell isn't getting another season. The next day, Friday, January 26th, they find out Russell Crowe has apparently read Nottingham and wants to play the sheriff. So over the weekend, WMA put together a package deal. Russell Crowe and the Nottingham script, a project ready to go for any studio who wants to make an offer. This is a process called packaging, where agencies will bundle together their talent into a package deal to sell to studios. Packaging is a kind of controversial process. From a studio perspective, it saves time, they don't have to find a star for a script or a script for a star, and sometimes there'll be a director thrown in too, but there is the possibility that you end up with a package of odds and ends, the wrong director for the right script or vice versa. Agencies are the big winners of package deals. It means they can use their own network of talent to boost new names, mixing a hot script and an established actor, and it's a way to secure good scripts for your talent. But agencies also used to get a packaging fee from studios for putting together these deals, and this is where we run into the disadvantages of packaging, which mostly affect talent. Agents are meant to represent their clients' best interests. But if agencies are packaging together deals so they can get a commission from the studios, that's not actually the agency representing their clients, that's the agency representing itself. And sometimes, agencies would take bad deals for some of their talent in order to get a whole package through, or even misrepresent things to their clients in order to get them to sign on for the package. And I'm using past tense here because a couple of years ago, the Writers Guild of America brought an antitrust lawsuit against the big agencies for packaging fees, and now they're forbidden under WGA regulations. Although packaging itself is still allowed, agencies just can't charge a commission for it. But that was all in the distant future in January 2007, when WMA spent a weekend putting together the package deal pairing Russell Crowe with the Nottingham script. They sent that pitch package out to studios on Monday, saying they weren't taking any bids until Tuesday morning to give the studios time to read the script and put together their best offers. And on Tuesday morning, there was a bidding war over Nottingham, largely between Universal and Warner Brothers, but DreamWorks, Regency, and Columbia were all interested as well. Several studios even found the time to attach a high-profile director to their bid, including Spider-Man's Sam Raimi, National Treasure's John Turteltaub, and X-Men's Bryan Singer. There was also some interest in Nottingham at 20th Century Fox, because Ridley Scott approached the studio and asked them to buy the project so he could produce it for them through his company, Scott Free Entertainment. This would have been a similar deal to what ended up happening at Universal, where Universal ponied up the cash and Imagine Entertainment actually made the film. And according to Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris, Universal's cash was actually slightly less than another studio offered, but Russell Crowe had a good relationship with Universal, and with Imagine Entertainment, and with Imagine's co-founder, Brian Grazer, who had previously worked with Russell Crowe on A Beautiful Mind, Cinderella Man, and American Gangster, and who would end up personally producing Nottingham. Russell Crowe trusted Brian Grazer with the project. That's why he accepted a slightly lower bid. And while Wreath and Forest didn't get anywhere near Russell Crowe's $20 million, they did get a pretty good price for the script. Reports from the time said the writers were getting seven figures, but a few years later, The Wrap published a leaked production budget for the film, which suggested that Wreath and Forest were actually paid $750,000 for the script, which they then would have had to split between the two of them, as well as paying any agent's commission or manager fees. Now, Universal have publicly said that this leaked budget was outdated and inaccurate. But the script rights would have been one of the first checks cut on the film, so it's really hard to imagine how that particular line of the budget could have been outdated. When Universal bought Nottingham in 2007, producer Brian Grazer was hopeful that they'd be able to start shooting by the end of the year, or in early 2008. But in April 2007, Ridley Scott came on board as the film's director, rather than just its producer. And Ridley Scott was a big get. He's Ridley Scott. He's Mr. Alien, Mr. Blade Runner, Mr. Gladiator, Mr. Thelma and Louise, Mr. House of Gucci, Mr. Kingdom of Heaven Director's Cut, and no other versions of that film. He also had form with Russell Crowe between Gladiator, American Gangster, and A Good Year, a lightweight 2006 comedy where Russell Crowe inherits a winery in the south of France, which no one remembers except for me. But I remember it, Ridley. I remember it. And because Ridley Scott was such a big get, he wasn't able to jump straight into Nottingham. He was committed to making Body of Lies for Warner Brothers first, so the Nottingham shoot was officially pushed into 2008. Russell Crowe ended up signing on for Body of Lies as well. He'd been pretty heavily courted for the role around the same time that Scott signed on to Nottingham, but that seems to have just been a coincidence rather than any sort of deal between the actor and director. Crowe actually held out on Body of Lies for quite a while because he was waiting on a polished draft of the script by a new writer. This is foreshadowing. So Russell Crowe and Ridley Scott were busy filming Body of Lies until December 2007, but by June 2008, Nottingham was lining up to start shooting in August in the UK on a $150 million budget. Now, I know budget numbers can kind of start to blur together, so for some contemporary comparisons, that's more than twice the budget of Body of Lies, and it was only $10 million less than Inception. Nottingham was a pricey project, especially in a pre-Avatar, pre-Iron Man 2008. Now, if you've listened to previous seasons of the show, you might have noticed we're talking about a very familiar time period, late 2007 and early 2008. But for once, the simmering industrial issues that affected Nottingham didn't come from the Writers Guild. They came from the Screen Actors Guild, who had been vocally supportive of the striking writers and who were now eyeing up a strike of their own when their contract with the AMPTP expired at the end of June 2008. Negotiations were not going well and there was a real sense of pessimism in the air. And after the writers' strike, the studios were in a retaliatory mood. There was talk of a lockout if negotiations went past the contract expiration, which would have meant studios barred union actors from their sets until a new contract was signed. It's kind of the studio equivalent of, you can't fire me, I quit. This would have been a pretty drastic move, and it didn't go ahead, but studios still began winding up their commitments as the potential strike approached. And Nottingham, due to start filming in August, was one of the films being weighed up, even as casting and pre-production began in earnest. Sienna Miller was cast as Marion, but even when her casting was announced, she was cautious that the strike could kill the film in its cradle. The Daily Mail also reported that Christian Bale was being pursued for the role of Robin, with Vanessa Redgrave, Saoirse Ronan, and William Hurt also in discussions for the film. William Hurt is in the film, playing William Marshall, a historical figure who does not appear at all in Wreath and Forest's script. And Vanessa Redgrave was initially cast as Eleanor of Aquitaine, but pulled out after a family tragedy and was replaced during the shoot with Eileen Atkins. But Christian Bale is not in the film, and neither is Saoirse Ronan. By July 2008, the actors' strike hadn't happened, but the delay on Nottingham had. Filming was officially pushed back to March 2009, and Universal either shot themselves in the foot or did something quietly genius when they decided to partly blame the delay on trees. Most publications ran with the line from Universal's press release, which said they delayed Nottingham because they couldn't shoot in winter because, quote, the film's forest locations need to be green. this is funny. It's a funny way to put it, but it is also true. Aside from just the visual issue of trying to shoot out of season in a forest, shooting in a forest in winter can be dangerous and it's definitely more expensive. But in that same press release, Universal also gave two other reasons for the delay that weren't as widely reported. They said that the potential actors' strike had left a cloud over the film, and that the script was, quote, not yet where the studio and the filmmakers want it to be in terms of realizing the full value of the story. When Ridley Scott came onto Nottingham, he didn't love Reifenvoorus' script. In August 2008, Universal chairman Mark Schmuger told Patrick Goldstein that, quote, the script had the Sheriff of Nottingham as a CSI-style forensics investigator set in medieval times. It was really well written, but Ridley's interest took him in a different direction. That different direction meant a substantial rewrite from Brian Helgeland, the writer of LA Confidential and A Knight's Tale. Here's Ridley Scott and Brian Helgeland.
It was essentially, you know, it's fair to say, page one rewrite, because what they had and where we went were two different universes.
I got a call from Ridley Scott, who was going to direct the film, and he said that he was involved in a Robin Hood film, but it wasn't the version of it that he wanted to do. And he wanted to do basically a version of the untold story of Robin Hood, or the man before the myth version of Robin Hood.
Helgeland would end up with both a screenplay and a story credit on the film, and by the time Nottingham's shoot was delayed, Ridley Scott was describing the film as something completely different to the script that Universal had bought. In mid-2008, Scott said that in his film, the sheriff was King Richard's right-hand man during the Crusades, but when Richard was killed on his way back to England, his brother John became king and the sheriff was torn between his duty to the crown and the people. King John was the bad guy of the film, according to Scott, who said that John was actually pretty smart, but he got a bad rap because he introduced taxation. Ridley Scott never made any mention of the serial killer plotline, but there's also another character that Scott doesn't mention in his summary of the film, Robin Hood. And that's because Brian Helgeland's script combined the two roles of the sheriff and Robin Hood. Russell Crowe's Robin would now steal the sheriff's identity when he was killed in battle and then head back to England, doing a full Don Draper. In September 2008, Ridley Scott confirmed that Russell Crowe would be playing both Robin and the sheriff, saying that the dual roles would be, quote, a good old clever adjustment of characters. One becomes the other. It changes. But even as Scott confirmed that dual role, which was Brian Helgeland's idea, another writer was having a crack at Nottingham. He was a Brit named Paul Webb, who specialises in historical scripts. His breakthrough was a play called Four Nights in Knaresborough about the 12th century assassination of an archbishop, and Webb was commissioned by Steven Spielberg to write a screenplay about Abraham Lincoln, which ultimately Spielberg didn't use when he made Lincoln. Paul Webb's draft of Nottingham was reportedly more serious than Brian Helgeland's, and it wasn't good enough for Ridley Scott. In early 2009, with the shoot just a couple of months away, Scott went back to Helgeland for another draft. It's unclear how much of Webb's work remained, but he didn't end up with a credit, and Helgeland ended up with two. And as Helgeland rushed through a new draft of the script, it drifted even further from his own ideas. Robin would no longer adopt the identity of the sheriff, but instead, another nobleman named Sir Robert Locksley. Within the Robin Hood legend, Locksley is often Robin's home and title before he's outlawed. He is usually Robin of Locksley. But here's 2009 Russell Crowe with some historical textual analysis.
You know, having read some 20, 30 books or something like that on the subject, there is a period of 300 years in which this legend seems to have been created. So between, I think, 860 AD... all the way through to the sort of romanticized version of Robin Hood. You know, this is 1,000 years of storytelling. And on top of that, you have probably now 100 years of cinema history, you know. And, you know, certain things that we come to think of as being absolute in terms of Robin Hood, you know, certain names like Locksley or whatever, you know, then you find out that that only came in recently in 1890 with a book, you know, and that was never before, there before, you know.
So here's how the whole Locksley thing goes in the final film. Russell Crowe's Robin Longstride is a soldier in King Richard's army who, after the death of the king, decides to desert with some mates and try to get on the first boat back to England. At the same time, one of King Richard's former right-hand men, Sir Robert Locksley, is delivering Richard's crown to the next king, John, when he's ambushed by French soldiers who think that Locksley is King Richard because he's on the king's horse. The French massacre Locksley's men and are about to take the crown from the horse's saddlebag, but the horse bolts and comes across Robin and his gang, who follow the horse back to the ambush and chase off the French. And with his dying breath, Sir Robert Locksley makes Robin swear that he will take Locksley's sword back to his elderly father, Sir Walter, in Nottingham. No mention of the crown. Locksley dies, and Robin and his gang of merry adjacent men loot the corpse and discover the crown and Locksley's secret travel itinerary back to England. So Robin cooks up a plan. He will pretend to be Sir Robert, and they'll get a free ride back to England to deliver the crown, plus the new King John will be so grateful he'll grant them a generous reward. John is an asshole, so he doesn't, but after the crown is returned, Robin then goes to Locksley's home in Nottingham to return the sword and meets Sir Walter and Locksley's widow, Marion. Sir Walter then asks Robin to fully assume Locksley's identity because Locksley and Marion were childless, so when Sir Walter dies, the land will go to the crown instead of to Marion. So Robin and Marion are stuck in a whole new ruse where they're playing house while Marion grapples with the death of the husband she barely knew, and lifelong soldier Robin adjusts to the responsibility of caring for a village and also a kind of wife. There is also a whole subplot about how Robin's father was executed when he was a child, and there's a hidden inscription on Locksley's sword handle that gives Robin a PTSD flashback to the execution, and it turns out that Robin's father was a friend and ally of Sir Walter, and they were both part of a group of rebel noblemen who wrote a seditious proposal for a Bill of Rights, which is pretty clearly a proto-Magna Carta, which for any Americans listening, the Magna Carta is like a proto-Declaration of Independence, except it declared you were very dependent and asked for the most basic of human rights, but also gets quoted a lot by sovereign citizen weirdos. But Robin's father was discovered and refused to give up the names of the rebel noblemen or the Bill of Rights, so he was executed for it, and Robin has always assumed he was abandoned. Sir Walter is able to tell Robin all of this and restore his pride in his family, and this is all very relevant to the narrative, but also entirely irrelevant to the whole identity theft plot. As the new Lord Locksley, Robin is the leader of the local community, but he is crucially not the Sheriff of Nottingham, who is a whole other guy played by Succession's Matthew McFadyen, who shows up every half hour or so to sexually harass Marion.
To see Lady Marion Locksley's legs, beyond my wildest hopes this morning.
If that sounds convoluted, almost like ideas from multiple scripts were Frankenstein together, now you know why. And one of the biggest fallouts of this new draft actually came through in casting. In February 2009, Sienna Miller left the project and was replaced with Cate Blanchett. Miller later told Contact Music that the latest round of rewrites meant that at 26, she was now too young for the role of Marion. Ridley Scott would also later say that the age gap between Miller and Crowe made Robin look like he was marrying his own daughter. The new Marion, Cate Blanchett, was 12 years older than Miller, and was also Cate Blanchett. Russell Crowe was the one who was really responsible for getting Blanchett on board after proposing the project to her at the launch of a new range of Australian stamps that they were both featured on. We are a deeply unserious country. The cast was eventually filled out as well with some Body of Lies alumni. Mark Strong plays the villainous French double agent Sir Godfrey, while Oscar Isaac wears a pair of unsettling blue contacts to play King John. Rhys Ifans was initially rumoured to be playing King Richard, but the role ended up going to Danny Houston, meaning that the film has an Australian Robin and Marion, an American King Richard and King John, and a mix of Canadian and American merry men. The film's highest billed English actor is Mark Strong, who plays a French traitor. Robin Hood also gave Russell Crowe a chance to reunite with an old co-star, George, his horse from Gladiator. Here's Russell Crowe on The Late Show.
Like, here you are in Gladiator. Let's
have a look. Can I have a look?
Yeah, there you go.
Right, that's George.
That's George?
Yeah, so many years later, I was on Robin Hood, and George was assigned to of the other characters. Yeah. But I had a little chat with George.
Ten years later, this horse recognized you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I went up to George, and I said to him, very quietly, hello, George. And he sort of put his head down and so sort of pushed into my chest a little bit. And I said, do you realise we won the Academy Award?
In February 2009, Ridley Scott mentioned in passing to MTV that Robin Hood would start filming in a couple of months. This was the official confirmation that the movie was no longer called Nottingham. Ridley Scott never liked the name Nottingham. He would actually often call it Robin Hood prior to any official change, and he'd later tell the Sunday Times that, quote, "If you're going to invest in a Robin Hood story, why call it Nottingham? You'd end up spending 80% of the publicity budget explaining why it's Nottingham, not just Robin Hood." There was once a very good reason that the film was called Nottingham, not just Robin Hood, because it was about the Sheriff of Nottingham, not Robin Hood. But by this point, that element of the script was completely gone. The shooting scripts and slates on the film would be labelled Untitled Robin Hood Adventure. In the same interview where he confirmed the name change, Ridley Scott also confirmed that Russell Crowe was now just playing Robin Hood, saying that the role doubling was, quote, "an idea so far back, way back when at the time I had this proposed to me and I read it and thought, I don't really know what it does for it, but it's all right. It is better to simply have the evolution of a character called Robin Hood." Scott also clarified that the villain of the film would now be the French. The sheriff, according to Ridley Scott, was, quote, "less important. He's always a kind of amusing character in most of the movies who represents the hierarchy in the story at that point. The hierarchy and the wealthy always ruled over the underclass, and fundamentally that doesn't change, because Robin Hood is actually the one who finally, in terms of the overall classical idea of the film, will help the poor, probably taking from the rich." In retrospect, it's very funny for Ridley Scott to insist that they were now making a movie solely about the evolution of Robin Hood and then say in almost the same breath that he would probably be robbing from the rich to give to the poor. Shooting began on the Untitled Robin Hood Adventure on the 30th of March 2009. And 2 days later, on the 1st of April, Brian Helgeland's blue shooting script was distributed to the crew. On film shoots, it's common practice to print scripts on coloured paper, so if there are any changes, you can print those changes on a new colour, which has two big advantages. One, you can tell at a glance if someone has the most up-to-date script by what colour their pages are, and two, you only have to reprint pages that have changes rather than reprinting an entire script every time there's a few things that have been updated. So on Robin Hood, everyone started out with a blue shooting script on the 1st of April, and then 2 weeks later they were given updated pink pages to slot into that blue script. 2 weeks after that, they were given a round of yellow pages. And then on the 1st of May, a month into the shoot, there was a whole new green draft. So that meant scrap the blue draft with the pink and yellow updates. Enough had been changed through the entire script to justify reprinting the whole thing. And the revisions in that green shooting script were done by Brian Helgeland. But on set, another writer, Tom Stoppard, was polishing the dialogue. And yes, that is Tom Stoppard, the absurdist British playwright who wrote Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Stoppard is also an Oscar-winning screenwriter, and he's done a lot of work as a script doctor. He even did a dialogue polish on Revenge of the Sith. And his changes on Robin Hood seem to have been frequent and significant. In a set visit, Dame Eileen Atkins told the Daily Mail that, quote, "they keep rewriting the script and changing my lines quite dramatically, so I'm terrified of forgetting them." And over time, the cost of these rewrites started to pile up. The film itself was proving to be far more expensive than Universal and Imagine Entertainment described it. They insisted upon release that the film only cost $155 million. But according to the leaked budget published by The Wrap, which Universal has said was inaccurate, but which claims to be from January 2009, the total cost of the film was more like $237 million, or around $200 million after tax breaks. $6.7 million of that budget was for writing fees, in addition to the $750,000 that had been paid for the original Nottingham script. Meaning, in the end, around $7.5 million was spent on the script for Robin Hood. And 90% of that was spent rewriting the script that the film had been greenlit with. It's also possible that the rewriting costs climbed much higher during production, since this budget was dated January, before shooting began, and possibly before Tom Stoppard was brought onto the film. When it was being made, Robin Hood was often, inevitably, compared to Gladiator. Here's producer Brian Grazer in the making of documentary.
I guess I've always felt like if we make this movie, Ridley and Russell and I, that it would be kind of the gladiator version of Robin Hood. You know, I wanted to experience the Crusades, experience a really brutal time.
Ridley Scott, for his part, would invoke Gladiator to silence critics, telling The Times Online in 2008 to, quote, "Think of Gladiator. Everyone sniggered because they thought I was going to do a sandals and toga movie, but I knew exactly how to do it, and I know how to do Robin Hood." But on set, Russell Crowe bemoaned the constant Gladiator references, saying, quote, "It doesn't matter what we do, everyone always compares it to Gladiator. We do a little comedy set in the south of France and half the reviews had references to Gladiator." But Robin Hood very deliberately evokes Gladiator, with its mud and grime and leather and rough blokes living through brutal times. Ridley Scott even leaned into the comparison by having Russell Crowe's hair and beard cut exactly how it was at the start of Gladiator. And Mark Streitenfeld's score goes to great lengths to remind you of Hans Zimmer and co's work on Gladiator. And even Russell Crowe couldn't help bringing up Gladiator.
If Gladiator was a metaphor for death, in this, it's about life. It's about birth.
So, let's do it. Let's compare Robin Hood to Gladiator. After all, Gladiator famously went into production without a finished script and had constant on-set rewrites. And it also tracks a Russell Crowe soldier hero across multiple countries after his life is turned upside down by the death of a good leader and his replacement by a vain, cowardly man-child. But Gladiator is a very focused film. It is Maximus's story. Maximus is the point to which all the different plotlines are anchored, and he has a personal involvement in all of them. He's living through his Gladiator story and he wants revenge on Commodus, but he also wants Rome restored to a republic because it was Marcus Aurelius's dying wish that Maximus would oversee that transition. And Maximus wants Lucilla and her son to be safe from Commodus, partly because he lost his own wife and son to Commodus. And while the film does leave Maximus for quite long sections to follow Commodus and Lucilla and the senators' plotlines, we relate to those stories entirely through the lens of Maximus. But Robin Hood just doesn't manage to weave its stories together like Gladiator does. And when it tries by making Robin the heir apparent to the Magna Carta, it really feels like it's drawing a long bow, if you'll pardon the pun. And the problem really is with the story, because on a technical level, it's a Ridley Scott movie. The scale, the costumes, the cinematography, the vibes, they're all classic Ridley Scott. What really lets the movie down is the story. For those who haven't seen it, the first half of the film mostly follows Robin's adventures in identity theft, going from a soldier to a genuinely noble nobleman trying to right the wrongs that are going on in the land. This mostly concerns the fact that all the boys of Nottingham Village have disappeared into the forest and are living as a sort of feral children's robber community, surviving by stealing from the landed gentry, which is Marian. In this version of Robin Hood, Marian is the rich being robbed. There were some scenes that showed Marian was secretly in cahoots with these children, keeping a quiet eye on them, which was discovered by Robin when he was kidnapped by the runaways, leading to quite a fun scene between Robin, Marian, and Loop, the chief of the feral children.
He was spying, Loop.
Spying?
Robert,
I'm ashamed of you.
Hello, Marian. I've come to save you.
Boys, this is Sir Robert Locksley, my husband.
Sir Robert?
The runaways of Sherwood.
You were a crusader?
Yes.
You hear up, boys? You bastard a crusader!
Robin ended up offering to help the runaways and teach them how to make better bows, but this scene and several others of everyday life in Nottingham were cut from the theatrical version of the film. Which is a shame, because these Nottingham sections are easily the strongest part of the movie, and they're where it feels most like a Robin Hood film. The Nottingham section is where all the characters really sing. They're where Robin seems like someone who actually cares about the people, who sets his sights on bringing hope and joy back to a village hit by hard times. Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett pull off a genuinely charming fake dating romance between Robin and Marian, and Robin's gang of merry adjacent men are just a bunch of fun, rowdy, dirty boys along for the ride. Matthew McFadyen's sheriff is a petty, low-stakes asshole, and Mark Addy's Friar Tuck knows he's in a Robin Hood movie. Nottingham is also where we get the one instance of robbing from the rich in this movie, when Robin and his boys reclaim some seed grain from a church delegation who were taking it to York. And if this film were mostly the Nottingham story, if there was a shorter opening and it ended with Robin protecting the village from a marauding and violent tax collecting force so you could still have some big Ridley Scott battle scenes, I think this would be a genuinely great Robin Hood movie. But that's only about a third of the film. The rest involves a plot by King Philip of France to undermine John's reign, using his double agent Sir Godfrey to sow discontent across the land with gleefully violent tax collection, while John cuts himself off from the wise counsel of William Marshall, who served his father and brother and was also part of the proto-Magna Carta gang. And this isn't necessarily a bad story. One of the best scenes in the film comes from this. It's a very short little power play between Mark Strong's Godfrey and William Hurt's Marshall, right after Oscar Isaac's John has stripped Marshall of his ring of office. It starts with Marshall hearing Godfrey's approach and raising his hands, saying,
"Choose carefully, Godfrey, the spot where you would place your dagger. For I will choose carefully as well."
And Godfrey doesn't say anything. He just puts on Marshall's old ring of office and then walks off with his hands sarcastically up in the air. It's a really fun, really Ridley Scott moment, but what is it doing in a Robin Hood movie? And if this is the sort of political intrigue tone that Scott wanted the film to hit, why does he also spend so much time teasing the words "merry men" like it's goddamn Avengers Assemble?
"I'll come with you."
"No, you're not. We don't take strays."
"The more the merrier."
"I demand to know who you are."
"We are men of the hood. Merry now at your expense."
And why is the climax of this Robin Hood movie the attempted invasion of England by the French, by which point all the barons of the north have already gathered to march on London in a full-on rebellion against King John, but William Marshall convinces John to go to them and ask for forgiveness and beg for their help in fighting the French, and then John, the barons, and Robin all publicly debate about the value of kings and taxation without representation and this cool new Charter of Rights that Robin's father wrote, and then Robin drops a truly insane line for any Australians in the audience.
"So what would you have? Castle for every man?"
"Every Englishman's home is his castle."
Okay, this is a complete tangent, but Ridley Scott's done this twice now and it needs to be discussed. "Every man's home is his castle" is a saying, but it has a unique meaning and resonance in Australia because of a cult classic 90s comedy called The Castle.
"It's not a house, it's a home. A man's home is his castle."
Russell Crowe would have absolutely been aware of how this line would read to Australian audiences, and the fact it's said with a little camera push in and a swell in the score makes it feel like the closing line of an SNL sketch.
"Every Englishman's home is his castle."
And this would just be a weird little coincidence that I wouldn't mention if Ridley Scott hadn't done it again in Napoleon, referencing another 90s Australian viral video of a man being arrested after eating a succulent Chinese meal.
"I am eating my breakfast. I am enjoying a succulent breakfast."
"What is the charge? Eating a meal? A succulent Chinese meal?"
Anyway, after Robin's rousing speech, John agrees to sign the Charter of Rights if Robin and the other barons help him fight the French. And then they actually go back to Nottingham because Godfrey and his marauding French tax collectors have attacked the town and killed Sir Walter and locked the villagers in a barn and started to burn it down. So Robin and some of the northern barons and all of the feral children have to rescue the townspeople, and then they go to the coast for another battle scene straight out of Saving Private Ryan, brackets medieval. But because there's another, more character-motivated battle scene in Nottingham immediately before this, the beach battle scene feels really tacked on to the end of the film. And you can probably guess by now that that's because the beach battle scene was tacked on, which was a real pain for several departments. Here's the film's executive producer, Charles Schlissel, and its master armourer, Simon Atherton, in the behind-the-scenes doco.
"The finale of the movie was originally supposed to be in Nottingham. It was supposed to be here, on dry land, with people like hacking away with swords and things like that."
"Eventually it evolved into this sea battle. By that time, we had built a lot of the equipment. So, you know, when all of a sudden they said, this is it, we're all going to immerse everybody in the sea, you could see two or three departments just crumple. You know, wardrobe were thinking, oh my God." I was the same. You know, all the leather belts will turn into Rice Krispies. They'll all start crumbling and dying. And we had to spent ages every night putting oils back into the leatherwork.
The beach battle scene ends with Robin pulling off an incredible archery long shot that kills Godfrey. But when the French surrender to Robin, John is humiliated and reneges on his promise, burning the Proto Magna Carta and banishing Robin for the various crimes he's committed throughout the film. So the movie ends with Robin and all of his merry men going to live in Sherwood Forest as outlaws, where, as Marion explains in the voiceover, there is
no tax, no tithe, nobody rich, nobody poor. Fair shares for all at nature's table. Many wrongs to be righted in the country of King John.
We then fade to a title card declaring, "And so the legend begins." When Ridley Scott was asked about the provenance of this film just before its release, he told the New York Times that, quote, "Without realizing it, we devised a story that is about the forming of Robin Hood, the beginning of the legend and how he came to be, as opposed to what people already know." Which is an interesting way to put it, considering the journey this film went through. The final movie is a kind of radical reorganization of the Robin Hood myth, where instead of a noble who chooses to forgo his lands and live as an outlaw, Robin is a soldier of relative poverty, elevated to lordship through a scheme, who then becomes burdened with the responsibilities of being wealthy, who gets embroiled in a French conspiracy and also a radical movement by other English lords to institute the Magna Carta, and then has to fight a reverse D-Day battle against the French, is outlawed by King John for embarrassing him, and then becomes the Robin Hood we all know and love. If I had to sum this film up with a single word, it would be contradictory. Ridley Scott claims to be placing the Robin Hood myth into history and then creates an entirely fictional proto-Magna Carta mythology to put him in. The film applies modern morality and attitudes to an ahistorical, imagined representation of the Middle Ages, and it bills itself as grounded and realistic, but the plot hangs so much on contrivance that it becomes a story about fate and destiny, about circles of life and Robin finishing what his father started thanks to a special sword. In that respect, it's closer to a King Arthur film. And while it aims to be an origin story for Robin Hood, it doesn't have any actual Robin Hooding in it. There is at best one instance of Robin robbing from the rich to give to the poor in this film, and it's not giving to the poor, it's giving to himself, since what Robin steals is seed grain for his and Marion's fields. Several reviewers in 2010 referred to the film as Robin Hood Begins. But at least in Batman Begins, Bruce Wayne does a decent amount of Batmaning. And those critics clearly couldn't see into the future because they didn't know that in just 8 years there would be a full-throated Robin Hood but what if it's Batman Begins movie starring Taron Egerton, which quite literally has Robin living a Bruce Wayne double life as a noble and an outlaw, and ends with a sequel tease where Jamie Dornan's Will Scarlet has become Harvey Dent Two-Face. If you're gonna watch one 2010s Robin Hood movie, I'd actually recommend that one because it's completely unhinged. It feels like it was written by a 13-year-old, and that 13-year-old was me, and it's also almost half an hour shorter than the Ridley Scott film, which has a runtime of 2 hours and 20 minutes and feels like two, if not three, different movies soldered together. And it's not like Ridley Scott's other long movies, which track one man on an epic, often life-spanning journey. It's a bunch of disparate, unwieldy plot lines trying to exist simultaneously. The director's cut of the film is much better paced than the theatrical release and also has more of a classic Robin Hood living in Nottingham vibe, but controversial opinion, I will always consider the theatrical release as the true version of a film over any extended or director's cuts, even for Ridley Scott. There is also a deep irony that kind of needs to be acknowledged about this film, which is that it was made by rich people. Most films are, but in this particular case, we're talking about a producer whose films have made over $15 billion, a director who has kind of been knighted twice, and an actor who loves the South Sydney Rabbitohs so much, he bought them. When Robin Hood was being rewritten, one of the greatest financial crises in history happened. Everyday people who thought they were secure, who'd bought into the idea of a modern, egalitarian society where every man's home is his castle, were suddenly having their castles foreclosed on, and were forced to face how precarious their position really was. Shortly after the film's release in the UK, austerity policies gutted social services and the economy. We live in a society ripe for a Robin Hood story. But none of these issues would have personally affected the filmmakers. So instead, we have a movie about lords and kings and political intrigue where the lives of the poor are set dressing for a much more important conflict. Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris had an understandable reaction to Robin Hood. By the final cut, they recognized very little of their script in the film. Here's Cyrus Voris last year.
I will say that it still has it has a similar structure to our original script in that it opens with that battle in the Crusades and sort of leads into like going back to England, to Nottingham, to that element. And then also Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Eleanor, yeah.
Yeah, she's not as big a part as we had her in our script, but she still has a somewhat legit part in the movie. So those are sort of like the last dregs holdover of what we had written, you know, originally.
Ethan Reith, as a history nerd, also had some issues with Ridley Scott saying he wanted to do Robin Hood the way it really would have been, and then filling King Richard's army with longbowmen because in 1199 they would have been using crossbows. But I think Cyrus Voris kind of summed it up best when he said that, quote, "This was a hot screenplay, and ironically, I think the only person in Hollywood who didn't seem to like it was Ridley Scott." And this is the final contradiction of Robin Hood, the one that I can't quite wrap my head around. Ridley Scott tried to take Nottingham on as a producer, and then he came in as the director. But on set, he said that the script for Nottingham was, quote, "fucking ridiculous. It was terrible. A page one rewrite." Russell Crowe was kinder, saying,
"I was very enthusiastic about the possibility of a Robin Hood, but when I read the script, and no disrespect to Cyrus and Ethan, the guys that wrote it, but kind of read like CSI Sherwood Forest to me, you know, and I just wasn't into doing that."
In the film's making-of documentary, Russell Crowe and Brian Grazer tell slightly different versions of the film's genesis, which leaves out the agency packaging and the kind of Hollywood wheeling and dealing, and also kind of vibes like they didn't have the time to get their story straight, with both of them saying the other was the first to bring up the project.
"It began with Russell Crowe. It was a spec script that was given to me with Russell Crowe.
There was a script floating around called Nottingham. And Brian said to me, you know, there's this revival thing of Robin Hood from a different perspective. Would you like to do that?"
In a different interview, Russell Crowe would give an exact time and place to his first discussions with Brian Grazer about the film.
"As a simple question that Brian Grazer asked me one day in my trailer when we were shooting American Gangster, he said, do you think it's time to remake Robin Hood, you know? And I had a really big response to that, you know? It was a simple yes, but it was really loud."
And this baffles me more than Ridley Scott's contempt for the script, because Russell Crowe attached himself to Nottingham, and his involvement was what really sold the script, and yet he apparently had no interest in making it. Because if Russell Crowe wanted to make a Robin Hood movie, if Brian Grazer really planted that seed in his mind, surely it would have been easier to start from scratch. It is not hard to find a Robin Hood spec script. Since this film, 5 separate Robin Hood projects have gone into development at major studios. But to pick Nottingham, such a specific and different script, and then spend 2 years and millions of dollars doing a page one rewrite to turn it into the thing it deliberately wasn't, well, to use an example from one of the film's writers, it's like buying the rights to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, and then making The Lion King. In the final theatrical cut of Robin Hood, the Sheriff of Nottingham has just over 4 minutes of screen time, most of which he spends being a fussy, vain little loser, a caricature villain in a world full of clever political operators. He is a perfunctory character, demoted from even the second-rate villain status that he has in most Robin Hood films. Matthew McFadyen does his best, and there was one scene which I can only describe as deeply Tom Wamsgams coded, where the sheriff opportunistically stole a cartload of church taxes for himself during a raid, but this scene was deleted from all versions of the film. Which is a shame, because if it was in there, it would have meant the sheriff did more robbing the rich in this movie than Robin Hood. Ethan Reith and Cyrus Voris have a story credit on Robin Hood, which they were entitled to under WGA regulations because the project started with their script. And recently, reflecting on the Robin Hood experience on the Pottywood podcast, Cyrus Voris was drawn to a line from the second last scene of the Nottingham script.
Hey, really Ethan, cool. I don't know why it popped into my head, but you talk about thematically. For some reason, there's a line that Eleanor of Aquitaine says at the end of our Robin Hood script to the sheriff. And she says something like, men like you who are steeped in law and arithmetic help a kingdom to function, but the kingdom wouldn't exist without men like Robin Hood, because these are the kind of guys that make men proud to be English. I think that's something else that was sort of fun about that script and sort of interesting, was the notion that Robin Hood's like the hero. He's got all the trappings of a hero. Of course people are going to rally around this guy. He's a natural born leader. He's charismatic. He's sexy. The girls love him. The sheriff is the guy that gets the shit done.
And Robin Hood is the one that they end up making films about, not the sheriff. And not to psychoanalyze, but Voris is talking about writing here. Writing is a job that involves a lot of big picture thinking and also grinding and thankless work that can ultimately be disposable, especially if a big personality like Russell Crowe or Ridley Scott gets involved. And writers are not the only unsung heroes of the filmmaking process. Something like Robin Hood takes hundreds of people pouring everything they have into the film for months, if not years. Costume, casting, camera, construction, catering, armorers, audio assistants, accountants, animal wranglers, and actors. But the big personalities, the stars, the heroes, they're the ones who actually get people into cinemas. They're the ones that the entire modern film business is built around. Good word of mouth about a great script will increase a film's audience. But you're not going to earn an alleged $237 million budget back on good word of mouth. The harsh reality of Nottingham is that it was convenient. Russell Crowe wanted to do a Robin Hood film, so his agent found him a well-regarded Robin Hood script. It's that simple. And in spite of everything, Ethan Reith is proud that Robin Hood started with that script. Back in 2010, he told The Standard that, quote, "In 21st century Hollywood, very few movie projects originate with a screenplay. They mostly originate as a sequel, or an adaptation of a comic book, or a novel, or a magazine article, or as an old TV show, or a popular children's toy from the 80s. But this new Robin Hood began life as an original screenplay that my partner and I thought up and wrote on our own. And although the man who directed it appears to hold that original screenplay of ours in contempt, I still think it's a good thing for writers in general that a big-budget movie project financed by a major studio with an all-star cast and a renowned director started out as a bunch of words on a page." Going Rogue is written and presented by me, Tenzi Gardam, with editorial assistance from Charles O'Grady and Christian Byers. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you subscribe, chuck us a rating, maybe a review, and tell your mates. Good word of mouth might not make back a $237 million film budget, but it will help this show. You can follow the show and me on Twitter, Tumblr, and Blue Sky. And you can also email us at goingroguetansy@gmail.com. As always, our music is by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech and Shane Ivers from Silverman Sound Studios. And our logo uses a photo by Annika Mickelson.